Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome everyone. Today, we are continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, a special Earth Day, the State of the Earth. Joining us today will be Jane Goodall. Dr. Goodall is one of the primary voices for humanity. Dr. Goodall has served for more than 4 decades in letting us understand what is happening with primates, with the environment. She has lived and studied and helped in Tanzania. She's an ethnologist, conservationist. She is a UN messenger of peace. She spends about 300 days a year on the road speaking with students and children and government officials on animal conservation issues and the human threats to the planet's biodiversity and wildlife, educating young children about the importance of our neighbors in the animal kingdom has been one of Jane's fundamental priorities for inspiring and empowering them to care and preserve the natural world for humanity's and the planet's benefit. Founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, her roots and shoots, a global environmental and humanitarian program, motivates young people to learn the important challenges that face their communities and to implement projects to solve them. The Institute also promotes microcredit programs to impoverished women, education in sustainable farming methods, and special education for girls and women. She's received numerous international awards for her environmental and humanitarian work, including being named Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire, the prestigious Kyoto Prize in Japan, the Gandhi King Award for Nonviolence. She has written many books about her chimpanzee research and wildlife conservation and mindful eating and postmodern spirituality that engages the natural world with care and compassion. Her last book is Hope for Animals and Their World, How Endangered Species Are Being Rescued from the Brink, and a forthcoming book will be released in the autumn. Her website is janegoodall.org. She will be joined by another voice for humanity from India, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Dr. Shiva is an internationally renowned environmental and social activist and formerly one of India's top nuclear physicists. She is regarded as the leading pioneer behind India's ecological and ecofeminism movement. In 1982, Dr. Shiva founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, which led to the creation of an important organization dedicated to the restoration of organic farming across India and the preservation of indigenous knowledge and culture. And for several decades, Vandana has fought for changes in the globalized practices of agriculture and food. She's traveled the world speaking against biopiracy and patenting of indigenous knowledge by our large agricultural and pharmaceutical corporations. Her activist efforts have created grassroots organizations throughout the developing world to counter genetic engineering of crops, as well as empower women throughout the Third World. She's received numerous international awards, including the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, the UNEP's Global 500 Award, and the UN's Earth Day International Award. Among her more important books are Earth Democracy, Justice, Sustainability, and Peace, Manifestos on the Future of Food and Seed, Soil, Not Oil, and most recently, Making Peace with the Earth, Beyond Resources, Land, and Food Wars. Her websites are vandanashiva.org and navdanya.org. We'll go first to Jane Goodall. Nice to have you with us today.
It's very nice to be with you.
In keeping with Earth Day, I'd like to begin with a little more of a philosophical insight. Earth Day was originally created to inspire people to become aware and appreciative of the Earth's natural environment. And that was its original purpose when it was founded on April 22, 1970, by U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. Now, it was not until 1990 that Dennis Hayes made it international. The UN only designated this day as the International Mother Earth Day in 2009. Now, it's ironic that the origins of Earth Day are in the United States, but the U.S. is the largest culprit in failing to develop that awareness and appreciative respect for the Earth's natural resources and life. It's also interesting that Senator Nelson found his inspiration for this day after a trip to Santa Barbara, California, following the well-known horrific oil spill off the coast in 1969. It was his outrage at the oil industry and government collusion with the oil industry that prompted him to create this day for teach-ins across American campuses so younger generations would become aware of humanity's ability to devastate the environment. So this day marks the birth of modern environmental movements that held events on 2,000 college campuses and 10,000 primary and secondary schools. And I know that you are coming from a deeply spiritual place, and so I'd like for you to address an overview for us. Since Earth Day was founded 43 years ago, what do you feel has most changed in our understanding of what it means when we speak of the Earth, and particularly when we speak of the Earth as a highly complex living organism, such as Professor Lovelock's Gaia theory?
Well, you know, when I sort of began my work was in 1960, and really nobody was talking about the environment at that time. The what we called the equatorial forest belt, where the, you know, so many chimpanzees made their home. It really was a belt of forest right across from East Africa to the West Coast. And gradually, or perhaps not so gradually, from about the mid-70s, the forest was, you know, inroads were made, human populations grew explosively, the big timber companies moved in, and also mining. And today, the forest is no longer a belt. It's patches of increasingly fragmented forest. And, of course, at the same time, chimpanzees, gorillas, and all the other animals disappearing, and the bushmeat trade's begun. So just in Africa alone, I have seen, since I began, a horrific destruction of the natural world. And it was because of that that I left the forests of Gombe, where I did my research, to begin, you know, what could I try to do to help the chimpanzees who'd given me so much? And realizing how many of Africa's problems stemmed from the old legacy of colonialism, the slave trade, and how many of Africa's problems today are because of the big multinational companies moving in both cases, both the colonial days and now. The Africans left poorer, many farmers driven off their land, while international companies get richer from Africa's natural resources. And then traveling around the rest of the world and beginning to learn far more than I wish I knew about what's happening, you know, how the forests everywhere are disappearing, the deserts are spreading, we've got replications of dust bowls in China. Countries develop and suddenly realize that they better protect their own natural resources. But if they're rich and powerful, like China is becoming, then search for those natural resources somewhere else, and why not Africa? So it's I've seen, at the same time as all this destruction, there is a growing awareness everywhere. And you mentioned the United States. And back when the First Earth Day was founded, I think that Gaylord Nelson was amazed at how this day, that first day, just spread far bigger than he could possibly have imagined. It took off. It was grassroots. And it showed that the ordinary people, although they weren't talking about environmentalism, they were, in their own areas, angry at what was going on because they saw the pollution. They knew their air was polluted. They knew that their water was making them sick. They knew that small farmers were being driven off the land. And that's why that first day was such a success. And since then, more and more people have become aware, and I find that students across America and Europe and everywhere, they're way more aware than they used to be. So at the same time, we see things getting worse, but also things getting better. And it's sometimes very difficult to pinpoint, you know, where the middle line is. But on the whole, I still have hope, but only hope if everybody understands that it's up to all of us. We can't just blame the politicians. If it's a democracy and we're electing the politicians and we don't stand up for them when they propose a tough measure to ban fracking or oil drilling, we can't blame big business for doing things wrong if we continue to buy their products. So we have to now reach a stage when every day is Earth Day and every person realizes that we are all jointly responsible for saving the planet for the future.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. We are facing many threats on numerous fronts, from failed governmental environmental policies and deregulation, and corporations with short-term agendas that end up devastating the planet, as you said, to reap its resources. You use China as a reference. One-fifth of China is now a desert, and it has the fastest desertification of any country in the world. It also has one-half of all of the drinking water in China from all of its rivers and streams is beyond cleanup, meaning there is no public health policy they can do to clean it up, and it's getting worse. Its air is one of the most polluted in the world, and yet, as we speak, on this Earth Day, China now possesses upwards of 90% of the world's precious minerals, many of which are necessary for computers and cell phones. And they have done that first at the cost of their own resources depletion and its devastating consequences, where they did not consider the environment important or the cost to humans important. But now they're becoming aware that they have to. So then they're exploiting other countries without any concern for their people or land or pollution. It's no longer in their country. And as a result, they, the Chinese and the Americans and the Brazilians and the Indians, are simply looking at the devastation of their communities, but they're reaping resources by any means. Well, combined with that is climate change and global warming that is reinforced by our industrial paradigm that we are all part of. You mentioned we cannot blame just the politicians. We are all participating. If we consume, we participate. Therefore, we should be conscious in what we consume and what we do with it. Now, that said, I'm asking if you would please put the human face on climate change, the negative impacts of our current policies. And unless a cause becomes personal and becomes a moral action against a moral threat, climate change remains virtually abstract in almost everyone's minds, and it becomes easier to disbelieve and deny or simply disengage. So would you please speak on how you can give a more human and living face to climate change and offer the examples that you choose?
Well, let me tell you first how climate change first made a huge impact on me. And this is a personal story. It was at one of the State of the World forums, and the indigenous people from across the United States had gathered, well, the United States, North America, I should say, they'd gathered together to talk about the rape of their lands. And one of them, an Inuit elder from Greenland, was there. And he stood up in front of the people, and it was a large gathering from around the world, and he said, my brothers and sisters, I have a message for you from your brothers and sisters in the north. Up in the north, the ice is melting. And then he paused dramatically. Up in the north, the ice is melting. What will it take to melt the ice in the human heart? And as it happened, I actually went to Greenland about 2 years later, and I stood with him and other Inuit elders in front of that great ice wall that goes up to the ice cap across the north of the world. And the elders were crying, some of them. And one of them said, we would stand here in the middle of summer and the water wasn't melting, the ice wasn't melting. there we were in very early spring, and it was a raging torrent, and all around us the icebergs were cracking and melting. And they said, you know, it was solid ice at this time of year, just 15 years ago. And we were talking about the effect that this would have on sea levels. If all of the ice of the north melted, sea levels would go up about 11 feet around the world. And it just happened that I went directly from Greenland to Panama. And there I met with the indigenous people, elders, who had already begun moving their people off the offshore islands, because every time there was a high tide or a storm, those islands were now no longer habitable because of the rising sea levels. So for me, this was the most dramatic way to be forced into understanding this is something that's happening. This is something that's already affecting people's lives. And when I think of how climate change is affecting migration patterns of all kinds of different birds and sea mammals as well, and I think of, you know, the increasing cycle of drought in Africa, which is the continent I know best, but also the UK, I'm British, and we see completely different temperatures than I knew as a child. And so for me, it's a very personal understanding of what's going on, and it becomes, you know, a very vital part of our mission, my mission, to imbue the young people in our Roots and Shoots program with an understanding, but not just the doom and gloom, because if young people are told this is happening, you know, the reason I started Roots and Shoots is because I met so many university students, thoughtful high school students, who were either depressed or angry or mostly just apathetic. And they said, well, we feel like this because you people have compromised our future, and there's nothing we can do about it. And every time I look at a child, I feel desperate, because I know how we've damaged this beautiful planet since I was that age. You know, I'm nearly 80 now, so I've seen all these changes. But I don't think it's too late. Maybe I refuse to believe that, maybe I'm stupid. But I think if we all become involved, we still have a chance to turn things around. And that's what Roots and Shoots is all about. It's about young people learning about the problems, discussing them, choosing projects to make things better, to help people, to help animals, to help the environment, with a thread of let's learn to live in peace and harmony with the natural world. And this movement is now in 130 countries. It's growing all the time, and it's young people from preschool right the way through. And it's desperately important that they have hope. It's desperately important that they understand that each one of them makes a difference every single day. And that's why it's growing so fast, because it's enabling them to take part in making change.
I don't believe any person who knows you for one second would think that you're not fully aware of the dynamic exchanges in temperatures that are occurring. I also would do all that is possible to have people prepare for the changes that are coming. I'm working now in depth on a major documentary for 7 years called The 12 Tipping Points, and a book on it as well. And at least 4 of the 12 are tipped. They're not going to be untipped no matter what we do. Others we can intercede with. But I believe that no matter what's going to happen, we should still do the best we can to prepare to live in a world that will be altered. We had 121,000 extreme weather events, the worst in anyone's lifetime in the last 12 months alone. Over 12,000 of those were in the United States, where we had the most snow or the most rain or the hottest days in a row or the coldest days in a row. 50% of America is in severe drought, and 60% of that will not be undone in its drought. We're creating great dust bowls. We have dust in the sky that was similar to the mid-1930s in Kansas, we now have in Arizona, where you have miles and miles and miles of dust, but it's not dust, it's sand. And hence the consequences of a sandstorm hitting your property, your shrubs, your trees, and your house and the person are substantially more toxic. The dust created great lung infections. They even had a particular medical name for it when you were breathing in dust in the Great Dust Bowl. Again, we caused that. So now when we look, and we look in China, and we look at the 1.2 million Chinese who die each year from environmental pollution because of their policies, well, at the end of 10 years of this, it's already up to over 11 million preventable unnecessary deaths. And it's not even registering on anyone's radar, the gee whiz, shouldn't we stop this? Now, the part that I'm interested in, and the part that I believe I'm in alignment with you on, I know I am, is what can we do about this? So would you, as a environmental and social activist, and I meet a lot of them, including those in the anti-war movement and those who demonstrate and protest and organize because they believe it is their sacred duty on earth to do so, and they deeply feel it is essential for preserving life and universal well-being, I would like for you to share your perspective on following your sacred duty to speak against different injustices and to serve as a spokesperson for those whose voices are not heard. Not everyone knows their sacred purpose in life. In fact, very few really do. Otherwise, they would act upon it more diligently. So would you please speak on your own experience of how you defined a sacred duty in your life and what is necessary for we, the people, become aware of our own?
Well, I suppose that I became aware of what my purpose in life was. You know, it actually happened rather dramatically. Perhaps part of my purpose in life was to go out and spend time with the chimpanzees and thus be armed to confront some of the reductionist thought of the scientific community at the time, who told me that I shouldn't be talking about chimpanzees as having individuality and personality, that I couldn't talk about them having minds capable of thought, and I certainly couldn't talk about them having emotions because that was unique to the human species. And fortunately, although when I was told this at Cambridge University, I didn't have a college undergraduate degree, and Louis Leakey sent me in to get a PhD, and I was a bit nervous of these erudite professors, you know, who were telling me I'd done everything wrong. But fortunately, when I was a child, I had a wonderful teacher who taught me, well, that those professors are wrong. And that was my dog, Rusty. And so I think part of my purpose in this planet has been to help people to understand our true relationship with the rest of the animal kingdom, and that we're not that different, and that we share many of the things which once we used to think unique to us with many other kinds of animals, which gives us a new respect and a new sense of horror at some of the things that we're doing to them. And just to digress for a moment, this ties in directly with climate change, because as more and more people eat more and more meat, this is causing huge areas of forest to be cut down to grow grain to feed these livestock or to graze cattle. It's wasting huge amounts of water to turn vegetable protein into animal protein. And these animals in these horrific factory farms, intensive farms, they are fed unnatural foods. They're fed corn, even ground-up animals, and of course they're vegetarian, meant to be eating grass. And they are, you know, passing more gas as a result, and that's methane gas. And that's a way more potent gas in the so-called greenhouse gases, even than CO2. So that's a little digression. But then the other part of my mission is sharing what I've learned with the rest of the world. And I was given two gifts, maybe one, communication. I've always loved writing. And I found, because I was plunged in the deep end, that I could also speak and speak to large groups of people and be effective. And this all happened just, boom, My childhood dream was to go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them. I ended up getting a PhD. I had an absolutely perfect life out with the Gombe chimpanzees, writing and analyzing data and doing some teaching. And then I went to a conference in 86 where all the people studying chimps in Africa, non-invasive in the U.S., were gathered together for the very first time, and we had a session on conservation, and that was where it hit me that right across Africa, forests were disappearing and chimpanzees were being hunted for the bushmeat trade. And we had a session on conditions in some captive situations, secretly filmed footage of chimpanzees, our closest relatives, in 5-foot by 5-foot steel-barred barren cages, because they're so like us that they can be used as human guinea pigs. And I went into that conference planning to live this wonderful life that had happened, unfolded for me, and came out as an activist. And since then, I haven't been more than 3 weeks in any one place. And I now feel that I shall have to keep this up as long as I can, because it does make a difference. You know, I'm right here at the birthplace of Earth Day. I'm here in Madison, and yesterday I was with all Gaylord Nelson's family. And so it was a very meaningful day, and the place was packed, and I was signing books for 3 hours, and people were crying. So if we have a gift, we have to use it. And that's what I tell the students that I meet every single day.
That's beautiful. I just have a few more questions. And normally on our conversations, we bounce back and forth, but I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought because you're segueing from one thought into another seamlessly. The other two issues that really concern me is the enormous land grabs, mainly in Africa, but not exclusively. It's at an epidemic level, mainly by multinational corporations, by hedge funds, and by people who want to buy the land so that they can control the price of commodities. Now, these are very wealthy people. They are billionaires, either individually or in their corporate interest. They don't need this. They're not going to eat any food from it. But it will impact billions of people who are going to be food scarce. Over 1 billion right now are food scarce. Share your thoughts on that. And then finally, there's a growing number of scholars and environmentalists who we are now saying have passed the peak when we can no longer realistically turn back climate trends. We can slow them down a bit, but the science is, it's literally preponderous in that no technology currently exists to prevent the terrible scenarios from being enacted. You mentioned being in Greenland. Well, when Antarctica, which is now as of this week, been shown to have more ice melting in the summertime, when it actually gets above 33 degrees, which historically it didn't, is causing massive amounts of runoff. That in turn could raise the oceans, if it all melted, by over 200 feet. And adding Greenland, now you see how bad it is. But our major glaciers, one in Peru that took 1,600 years to create, was melted completely in 25 years. That is right now. So all this is expanding the water supply. And the water, when it's warmed, expands. That increases the intensity of hurricanes. And all the people that I've spoken with who are experts in the field of climatology suggest that this year we should start to see some substantially harder hurricanes hit the United States. And we should start to see and expect and not be surprised by Category 2, 3, 4, and 5s, where a massive surge of water inland will make Hurricane Sandy, that adversely affected 5 million people and left over 500,000 homeless and without electricity, that will seem like a tropical storm compared to what's going to happen. And yet, we've learned no lesson. We're going right back out there and building on the beaches again. We value our property and value our views rather than value a realistic relationship with the natural world. So share your views on these two issues, our unwillingness to acknowledge the crisis we're in. More people are moving to Phoenix, and yet it's virtually impossible to sustain that city in Arizona because of its heat. and other people are moving on to earthquake zones in California and up the U.S. coast. Others are moving into parts of Texas down below Austin where there's no water. It's going to be in perpetual drought. And you have to think, what part of their relationship to the environment and the environment shifting are they not willing to understand? Not that they can't. Your thoughts on these two issues, please.
Well, I'm now okay. Well, let me start with the second one, which is in my mind. And yeah, we know all these things, and I think it must be people moving into these areas because they really don't accept climate change. They really think it's a whole lot of scientific nonsense. They're not prepared to believe it. They don't want to think about it. So they're going to go there anyway. Or they do understand, but as it's all inevitable, there's nothing they can do about it, and they may as well make the best use of these beautiful places while they can. And so, you know, I don't have too many views on why people do these things or why people don't take more notice of these horrific events that are happening, except that they feel so helpless that it doesn't matter what they do, so they might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And that's why I think it's so desperately important to help people, especially young people, understand that, yes, things may get worse, but there's still something we can do to stop it getting even worse than it's going to get. And the other thing is, you know, one of my reasons for hope is this extraordinary brain that we have. And the biggest difference between us and chimps is the explosive development of our intellect. And when you think that we actually launched a rocket up to Mars and a little robot crawled out and it's taking photographs of the red planet and sending them back for us to see, which should make us understand we better look after this planet of ours better because we really don't see any possibility of having a good life on Mars. And so our brain is so amazing. And as you said, we haven't got technology yet that can reverse things. Maybe in the future there will be that sort of technology. And those are the kind of feelings that must sustain us as we desperately struggle to get people to do their bit so that at least we can slow things down. At least we can, you know, try and make some impact, but only if all of us get into the act, only if we can overcome apathy. And we will never overcome apathy if people have no hope. That's, I feel really, really strongly about that. And that's why I'm spending, you know, so much of my time working with young people. And we can't predict the future. Yes, we can predict all these, you know, the worsening hurricanes and typhoons and all the rest of it. We see it happening all over the place. And I know people in Phoenix who say, you know, that everything's been shut down for days because of these dust storms and dust clouds. And, of course, I know about it in China, too. I've been in Beijing when you can't see the sky. And so my thoughts are, yes, we're in a right mess, and we'll get in a worse and worse mess quicker and quicker if we don't have people fighting and struggling to make change. Oh, the other thing you talked about was the land grabs. Boy, I do know about that. We have a big program south of Gombe in Tanzania. We're protecting some of the last forests of the chimpanzees, working with the local people, preparing them to receive red money, helping them to monitor the health of their forest, to protect the forest, to restore the forest. Huge enthusiasm there for doing this. People, the young people especially, proud of their forest and the animals in it. So, you know, these are the kind of things that we continually, you move forward and you're driven back. So we just have to go on fighting.
Very much appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Thank you very much, Dr. Jane Goodall. We appreciate them. Look forward to another conversation.
Thank you.
My guest, Dr. Jane Goodall, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, a special Earth Day on the State of the Earth. In a moment, our next panelist, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Please stay with us. ¶¶ Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, our Earth Day special, The State of the Earth. Now we're going to India, where Dr. Vandana Shiva, internationally renowned environmental and social activist, and formerly one of India's top nuclear physicists, is standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Shiva.
It's a pleasure to be back, Gary.
Would you please give us your assessment, take your time in depth, of where humanity and the Earth are at this historical moment of corporate globalization, and what we need to do as individuals? As you just were recalled, Dr. Goodall said that the vast majority of people in the United States and in England and Europe, they're not paying attention to the globalization efforts. They're not aware of genetically modified organisms and their significance, of animals eating animals and the methane gases, of what they buy and where it's going. They're living kind of in a stupor. So if you could address these, we would appreciate it. Just take whatever time you need.
I'm actually at this point traveling in southern India in the areas where the spices started, the areas which were called the Pepper Queen. People might not remember that pepper used to be exchanged in its weight for gold. And this is what brought Christopher Columbus, thinking he was coming to India, to the United States. And he discovered America. It was all for the spices. Today, these prosperous spice gardens are in a deep, deep crisis because there's dumping. And dumping is the process by which subsidized, low-quality products are allowed into markets through what is called free trade, but I think we should be calling it unfair trade, coercive unfair trade. That's what globalization is about. That is what is destroying our democracy, threatening the very fabric of our planet, undermining societies that have stood 10,000 years. And sustain themselves through all kinds of assaults and attacks. Globalization is nothing but deregulated commerce. But deregulated commerce means corporations have all the power. They're accountable to nobody because they belong nowhere. But they have the power over everybody. We can see this in the case of seed, which till recently used to be free, till recently was in the hands of farmers, and hundreds of thousands of varieties used to thrive, adapted to their ecosystems, adapted to the climate, adapted to the cuisine. Today, you have one company, not just controlling the seed with new licensing arrangements with the second biggest and the third biggest, so you basically have a cartel of about five chemicals that created war chemicals, turned them into agrochemicals, and now taking over the seed through genetic engineering. And if we look at what Monsanto, which is the single biggest controller of seed today, what it has done to get where it's got, and how this is linked to globalization, it should really wake everyone up. How did they start to even own the seed as if it was their invention and therefore they could patent it? They wrote the laws of the WTO, of the World Trade Organization. They wrote the clauses that force countries to patent seed and life forms, starting with patents on genetic engineering, but now they're moving into conventional conventionally bred seed. So they started to become law writers and replace democratic institutions of society. They've just repeated that this year in the United States recently with the Monsanto Protection Act, drafted into the financial bill, a little clause that says we will have all immunity from any court ruling. Now, when corporations get that powerful, A, in controlling the very beginning of the food chain. B, in imposing bad food on people. Nobody wants GMOs.
That is why they're so scared of labeling. That is why they spend millions of dollars to undermine the California ballot on the labeling of GMO food. But not only are they controlling large sectors of agriculture, which under any antitrust law should not be permitted, but the fact that the Justice Department's antitrust investigation against Monsanto was wrapped up abruptly shows the power of this company. The fact that they write the laws to protect themselves tells you what globalization is. Globalization is a very, very strange governance structure, where, as Monsanto said when it wrote the laws on intellectual property and patenting of seed, they said we were the patient, the diagnostician, the physician, all in one. Now, in any democracy, you've got to have a balance of powers. You have to have a group writing the laws, another group, the executive, implementing, and if things go wrong, you have to have justice systems calling this into account. Monsanto has become all of this in one, overriding courts, overriding democratic governments, and overriding citizens of the world. This basically means we now have a dictatorship. It's a dictatorship bigger than any dictatorship humanity has ever known. Mussolini and Hitler will be getting an inferiority complex with what Monsanto is able to do today. But the second is, because it's beyond the reach of any single government, it is able to trample on domestic laws. It's able to subvert decisions. And the costs of this are high. Not only do they write laws to protect themselves, they're now writing laws to criminalize our basic freedoms. They're criminalizing the saving of seed. Across the world, new laws are being written on to criminalize seed saving. New laws are being written to treat diversity as the problem, not GMOs as a threat to diversity. So you have a criminalization of citizens, you have a criminalization of ecological duties, and you have a protection and immunity to the criminals. This cannot go on, but it will not change from the top. The reason it will not change from the top is because the governments are now captive. This is what we've seen in the United States, and the United States, the entire foreign policy agenda of the United States has been reduced to one thing, pushing GMOs. And that is a tragedy. That is a huge tragedy, given what we know about GMOs, given what we know about the criminal actions of Monsanto, to have the largest democratic government of the world push undemocratic systems on other countries and on its own citizens, creates a deep, deep, deep crisis for freedom and democracy. So where will we defend these freedoms? We have to defend them by first starting the actions ourselves, being the change we want to see. That's why we have started Navdanya 25 years ago, and that's why 2 years ago we started the Global Citizens Campaign for Seed Freedom, connecting the dots across different parts of the world. While these corporations are one across the world, we are divided. We are not just divided nation by nation. We are divided gender by gender, class by class, race by race. And they play on this. If you look at the California ballot, they actually went out and create fears in the minds of the poor that your food bills will become costlier with labeling. So they play the divide and rule game. We have to be united in all our diversities. And that doesn't mean we have to have one uniform response, but we must be interconnected. Life is interconnected. Life is a web of interconnections. The defense of life in the face of these threats of destruction is a new politics of interconnectedness based on diversity and the celebration of life while we resist these deep and dark threats.
Very powerful insights. Let's expand on that. Dr. Goodall was talking about the land grabs in Africa. You've seen what has happened in India where they have the first or second largest population in the world. It's off by relatively small number between China, 1.3 billion, 1.28 billion. But they're both facing the same dynamic. Very, very educated upper middle class, lots of technocrats, lots of billionaires, lots of natural resources. But at the same time, between the two countries, you have the largest amount of abject poverty in the world. You have massive environmental degradation. As we mentioned with Dr. Goodall, you also have desertification. You have one-fifth of all of China is a desert, and it's eating up an enormous amount of land every day, every 24 hours. You also have one of the largest rivers in the world, and it's totally polluted. 50% of all the water in China is polluted. You have almost nearly 700 very poor people in China, and their growth was more important than their environmental balancing. The same is similar with India. Tell us about India and what's happening there, because that was the go-go economy for the last 10 years. It was Brazil, China, South Korea, and India. Now there's a consequence to when they did not pay attention to all those water holes being taken and overdevelopment in certain areas without natural resources to balance it. Give us that perspective, and also the land grabs and the degradation of their environment just for pure commodification. Share that with us, please.
My latest book, which is now out in the U.S., it's published by Pluto Press for U.S. and U.K., is called Making Peace with the Earth. And it is the story of land grab and resource grab in India that has been a consequence of globalization. India historically has been a prudent society, which is why such large numbers could be supported by this land. We are also one of the most ancient societies, and we couldn't have sustained ourselves over centuries without being prudent and sustainable in the way we use our resources and in the way we live in our ecosystems. What globalization did, and for us, the globalization period begins with two dates. One is 1991, when the World Bank and IMF imposed structural adjustment in the form of globalization on us. And then is 1995, when the World Trade Organization rules were further imposed. I call World Trade Organization rules of free trade as the irreversible structural adjustment. The first thing that happened was all of the polluting industry of the West descended on countries like India and China. Of course, China had been the factory of the world a little earlier, but if you look at steel, steel plants were closing down across North America. They were closing down in England. They were closing down in the Ruhr Valley of Germany. But we were opening up more and more and more steel plants. Aluminium was shutting down across the world. We were opening up new aluminium plants. All of these need lots of resources. You need to mine lots of iron ore. You need to mine lots of bauxite. Then you have to process it, for which you need lots of electricity, for which you need to mine more coal. And you need lots of water, because all of these are heavily polluting industries. And I will give you the stories of two places, one around aluminium and one around steel, about what this translates into in terms of a land grab. In Orissa, which is an eastern state of India, there is one of the world's biggest steel plants planned. The name of the steel plant is called POSCO. It will grab 4,500 hectares of the primeval coastal fertile areas. It will make rivers captive. It'll have a captive port, it'll have captive coal mines, and it'll have captive iron ore mines. The people of this region have been resisting. About 2 years ago, they asked me to support them to organize a biggish meeting in Delhi so that the parliamentarians and the media could all be informed. We then did a lot of research on POSCO and found that in 1997, when the Southeast Asian crisis took place, the World Bank put structural adjustment on Korea and forced them to privatize this plant. When we were doing this public hearing on the POSCO steel plant against the land grab, with a lot of police action and a lot of military action, we found that POSCO actually is owned by Wall Street. And Mr. Buffett has a 5% share in its ownership. Exactly when we were organizing to support the movements against the land grab, Mr. Buffett was traveling to India with Mr. Bill Gates on the art of giving, how to encourage philanthropy. And I had to do an open letter to Mr. Buffett to say, before you come around the world preaching the art of giving, why don't you take a few lessons on stopping the art of grabbing? Another place is a sacred mountain called Niamgiri. It's a bauxite hill. Bauxite is very, very good at absorbing water. Bauxite is the raw material for aluminium. Out of it come 32 streams. And an ancient tribe has been inhabiting this mountain. Niamgiri means the mountain that upholds the universal law. For them, this mountain is the axis for their entire universe. They've been resisting. They call me down. We built up a huge campaign, supported them, their resistance over years, and we stopped the bauxite mine. The aluminium company, which names itself Vedanta, which means beyond the Vedas, so knowledgeable and so wise, they tried to blackmail and say, okay, we'll shut down operations if you don't allow us to have this mine. And that kind of blackmail is constantly used to grab more and more land. An interesting thing about India, which I've written about deeply in my book because I've witnessed this and lived with it, I've been with the movements resisting this, is that India, after all, was a democracy. On paper, is a democracy. And because of our democratic structure, we had managed to shape laws to recognize the self-rule of tribals, which are the communities who are custodians of the richest forest areas, the richest mineral zones, the richest river basins. And this 1996 law on tribal self-rule allowed tribals to decide what would happen with their natural resources. And again, they would call me and others who were supporting them to be witness to decisions they were making at the collective level in the most amazing practice of consensus and participatory democracy. And they would make a rush decision. They'd sit two nights, three nights, four nights, full days, dancing at night, thinking during the day, and assess, if we get this steel plant, and they'll give us this much money for compensation, what do we lose? We lose our homelands, we lose our forests, we lose our ancestors, we lose our future. And over time, they'd say, no, this is not worth it. Money cannot replace our past, our future, and our homes in the forest. And one after the other, they said, no, we don't want this. That was the democratic response under the Constitution of India. And the corporations who had started to see millions and millions and millions of profits, of course, weren't going to let go. So they twisted the arm of government to create paramilitary structures to start attacking the tribals, exercising their democratic rights peacefully. Before we know it, violent movements started in these zones. Today, one-third of India is controlled by the Naxalites. And you have violence of the state, you have the violence of the corporate state, and then you have in response the violence of people trying to defend themselves and their resources and rights. I say that the war against the earth must become a war against people. The war against the earth must become a war against democracy, and not for citizen welfare. But because they are citizens, and citizens are used to their rights, and there's still structures of democracy. After the Wall Street collapse...
Dr. Shiva, unfortunately, we're out of time. You get started, you have so much to share, such a wonderful and insightful mind. My guest completing our discussion today on Earth Day is Dr. Vandana Shiva, and also much thanks to Dr. Jane Goodall. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening to Conversations with Remarkable Minds, an Earth Day special.
Oh, there's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what